Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 42 for September 26th, 2008. Roger Dannenberg of Audacity. Floss Weekly is brought to you by Visa. With every purchase, Visa prevents, detects, and resolves online fraud. Safe, secure, Visa. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers the wonderful world of free Libra and open source software. And Randall Schwartz is here. Not Randall Schwartz, as some of his friends, the wags in the chat room, call him. Randall Schwartz. Hey, Randall.
Hey, Leo. Good to talk to you. Hi.
I want to say, I just got a chat posting from somebody who said, of all the shows on the TWiT network, Floss to me is the most inspirational.
Thank you. That's amazing. Thank you for that. I've got to say, getting this back to a regular schedule has really invigorated me, and it's actually made me think of the kind of impact that this is probably having on the open source community, to have this kind of a platform where, you know, where your respected name being lent to something like this is making a lot of people aware of a lot of new things around the open source community.
It was one of the things that, there are many open source podcasts, some very, very good ones. A lot of the Linux users groups do them, and mm-hmm. so forth. And I, you know, people say, why don't you do a Linux podcast? And I say, no, you know, that's well covered. Why don't you talk about programming languages? I don't want to get that granular. I like the idea of having the mandate to just talk about the world of open source. And over the 2 years we've done this show with you and Chris DeBona, we've talked to many of the most important, most interesting, most significant people in open source. Today, we get to talk to somebody who created an open source program probably more people have used than almost any other.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
That's your cue to tell us who it is.
Sorry.
Who the hell are we talking to?
It's we're talking to Roger Dannenberg.
That's who we're talking to.
The guy who came up with the idea together with his grad student, Dominic Mazzoni. So Roger and Dominic came up with the original Audacity program back in 1999. Audacity started out as an audio editing system. So
still is. What do you mean?
It still is. Right. In fact, Audacity has become, I believe, the number one open source audio editing system.
Sure.
I mean, everybody's using it for everything. Yeah. You know, when people want to take, record some live sound and then snip out the stuff at the beginning and the end, or if they want to make a podcast, or if they want to, you know, rip some old cassette
I'm willing to wager more podcasts are made, and there are now 100,000 podcasts. More podcasts are made with Audacity than every other editor combined behind it.
I could easily see that. Yeah. I could easily see
it's
that.
It's free. So. It works on Mac, Windows, and Linux. You can get it from Audacity, audacity.sourceforge.net. And they've absolutely, one of the things I like about it, they've kept it up to date. There's always updates to it. There's lots of plugins. It does support, does it not, the standard VST plugins that, so you
it
can
supports
use
VST, but on the Mac, it also supports audio units, which there's a lot of as well.
Right.
So those are really nice. That's what everybody's coming up with now.
You can use commercial plugins. There are a lot of free plugins. You don't have to pay a penny really to get a very powerful editor. And I'll be honest with you, I think it beats Apple's commercial offering hands down.
And there's a scripting language named Nyquist built into it.
We're going to ask him about that because I think he wrote wrote that. Before we get to our fabulous guest, may I make a plug for shopping online safely?
Go right ahead, Leo.
I am a fan, of course. It's funny. I even buy my clothes online, my shoes, all my books, everything I buy online. And when I do, I use my Visa card because I'll be honest with you, when it comes to shopping, I don't take security lightly. And the good news about Visa is you're always safe and secure when you use your Visa card. Visa has the best state-of-the-art stuff to prevent, detect, resolve online fraud. They respond immediately to fraudulent activity. And I think the bottom line is they're there for you. They don't represent the merchant. They don't represent the hacker. They represent you, the consumer. And so if it ever comes down to a dispute, you always win. Well, what it comes down to is the word zero liability. You're just not liable for unauthorized purchases. When you shop online or off, take your Visa with you. That's peace of mind. Safe, secure Visa. So let us head to, I don't know where. Let's find out. Roger Dannenberg is on the line via Skype. Hi, Roger. When did you start Audacity?
I started Audacity. you know, I should know the answer to this. It's terrible. Should I look it up?
You don't actually know, like you could say the 80s would be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, well, it was in the 2000 timeframe.
Okay. I mean, Audacity, we've already kind of touched on this, but I mean, I want to underscore it. For the last 8 years, I've been recommending it as the free, powerful audio editor for Mac, Windows, and Linux. I mean, it's really kind of amazing. Was that your plan? Was it to make an open source editor that would be like kind of the definitive free editor?
No, I had no idea this would happen. When we started, Dominic and I were just trying to get something we could visualize some data with.
99.
Was it 99? Did you Wikipedia?
That was the chat room said that.
Oh, okay. Okay, that sounds about right.
And you were teaching at CMU at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
So was this a project or a student project? How did this come about?
Well, so I was working on various kinds of music information retrieval and other music projects. That's what I do, and I've been doing that for a long time.
I'm going to have to stop you. What is music information retrieval?
Okay, so music information retrieval is a field of study having to do with music and databases and accessing music. Mm. The main interest is content-based retrieval, which means instead of looking up a piece of music by its title, which is just like going to a library card catalog,
right,
looking up music by something like, you know, I want to be jogging at 125 beats per minute. Can I find a song that would match that?
It's not even metadata. It's actually the music itself.
Right. Mm. Actually looking at the signal content
kind
and features.
Kind of. That's very intriguing. Have you made many strides in this direction?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I would say. And there's now an international conference devoted to that subject. It just finished a week ago. So I'm all pumped up about music information retrieval right now.
Mm. So you were working on that. Graduate student comes to you and says, we ought to do Audacity.
Well, I think it was more the case of me being frustrated by not having, you know, very good tools to look at audio. And if I remember correctly, Dominic the Mazzoni, the grad student, was at the time, was working on some pitch analysis. We were actually working on a system called Query by Humming System, where you...
Which, by the way, they have now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Adobe, yeah.
Yeah.
So the idea is you sing this tune, you sing a tune that you're looking for, and we go search for it in a database.
Right.
And of course, doing pitch analysis of human singers is difficult, and actually quantizing those pitches and trying to make sense out of them, as in a melody, is also very difficult. And if you really can't look at the data and look at the output of your programs and compare them and listen to them and, you know, really think about it, then you just can't make progress.
Right.
And there are a lot of tools out there. Obviously, audio editors have been around, but they make it difficult to do things like if you had a program that was going to annotate that music and you wanted to display those annotations along with the audio waveform and be able to play it back. That kind of flexibility is just generally not out there. And so we thought it would be a good idea to make our own. And that's really where it got started.
Did you include, is this including all the commercial choices out there, or did it have to be, were you only looking at open source projects at the time?
Well, I think if there had been a good commercial solution, we would have been okay with that.
Oh, okay.
It turns out probably the best tools for doing music and audio viewing and annotation and this kind of flexible stuff are almost all open source programs that come out of research labs. I don't know of any commercial systems that would really do that.
And yet, this is a very fertile field for commercial applications. Musicians, you know, are all using computers now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, so I think the commercial things, the commercial audio tools and editors probably do a pretty good job for the normal things that people do. So if you're making music, if you're in a recording studio, then you have multiple companies competing for your business. If you're a researcher working in a lab and you want to, automatically attach pitch labels and display them for you, then you're pretty much out of luck on the commercial side.
Hmm. So you're just looking for a really good plug-in architecture? Is that what was missing?
Well, I think that might have solved our problem. What we really wanted, and the motivation here was to have the ability to really design our own display of not only waveforms but other data.
Okay, so like a textual track or something, notes or something.
Yeah, like a text track and a label track, and we were actually graphing pitch as a function of time. So that's kind of a waveform, but on a different, but on a pitch axis instead of an amplitude axis. So we wanted a lot more flexibility than other things could give us.
So some of this stuff's already in Audacity, obviously. You can have some track that has a series of numbers that displays alongside the actual soundtracks then?
Right, right. And in fact, there's some pitch analysis in Audacity that goes all the way back to the work we were doing at that time on Query by Humming.
It's kind of funny because I think a lot of the people that use Audacity, I include myself, are just using it as a very bare, just as an editor. We don't, you know, we're not using all these features.
Right, right. Well, and one of the, in fact, there's a feature in there that almost no one knows about. And in fact, I sort of thought it had just disappeared because I didn't see it in documentation or anyone mentioning it. And that's the fact that there is a way to display MIDI data, but in addition to MIDI data, you can actually put graphics in there. So you can display lines and boxes and circles and text labels. So you can kind of invent your own, plot your own graphics in a MIDI track. And it turns out that that's code that I wrote, you know, back in the very beginning when we wanted to be able to have a flexible system to put up labels and annotation. And that's all still in there. It's still not really documented. And I've been doing a lot of work on that recently to basically make all of that stuff work properly with editing. So maybe it's not quite at a state where we really want people using it, but there's a lot of interesting stuff in there.
So what is the current state of Audacity? Are you still working on the project, or are many's working on it? Who's on the team now?
Yeah, the best way to describe this, I think, would be that Audacity has really taken on its own life and its own organization. So there are, when I last looked on SourceForge, it said there were, I think, 53 developers.
Wow.
So now not all of those are active, and there's a much smaller but still pretty large group of people that are really actively working on it. And I would say the day-to-day maintenance and improvements to the system are not being done by me, and they're not being done by Dominic Mazzoni, the former grad student who worked on this. So it's really interesting because I mean Dominic may have met these people face to face, and he's certainly worked with a lot of developers more closely than I have. So recently, when I started getting back into some development work, I really came at the project, maybe with a little name recognition, but I had to go to I needed to go to the developers and say, well, here's what I'd like to do, and with your permission, here's how I'd like to do it. But I'm not at all in charge of things, which is good, because it's just amazing to me how much effort is going into this project. And it's not the kind of level of effort that I could, possibly sustain.
Well, it's a beloved project. It may be one of the best known open source projects out there right now.
It really is huge. And it amazes me just talking to people. I try to describe what I consider are my great accomplishments, and I kind of get blank stares, and then I ask them if they've used Audacity, and they say, oh yeah.
Well, if you buy a USB turntable right now, for instance, it comes with Audacity. I mean, it's out there in a big way, and I've been plugging it like crazy.
And especially with all the advent of everybody wanting to build podcasts and build audio distributions, mixtapes and everything. I mean, having a nice, powerful, open source audio editor with a lot of really nice features. I mean, like the noise removal thing. I mean, how did you think of that? Did you come up with that, or is that something that happened after you kind of went away for a while? Or
That happened, I think, after I was away for a while. And I believe, well, at least the first version was done by Dominic. Mm-hmm. And I was actually very surprised. I knew about the techniques, and perhaps we had talked about the technique, or maybe he learned it somewhere else. But I always assumed that making that work really well was going to take a lot of work and a lot of tweaking. And my understanding is that what's going on in Audacity is pretty straightforward. I mean, not that it would be trivial for anyone to come along and do it. And Dominic is just an amazing guy, but it does work really well. And it's using just very straightforward. Basically, the way that noise reduction works is there's a threshold that you set based on an example of noise, and when the signal falls below that threshold, the system just automatically clamps it to silence. And then the trick is you have to do that individually on each of many, many frequency channels. So
I thought that was the amazing part of it. It's like it basically, does essentially some sort of frequency banding, and I don't know how many channels, but it breaks it into like pieces and then figures out the noise level for each one of those and sets up essentially a tiny gate at each level. Very cool.
Right, right. There are many plugins for commercial audio editors that use essentially the same technique. It's amazing that something that simple works so well. The thing that kind of surprises me is that, when you're in there shutting these little gates on and off, you would expect that you'd have to just be very careful about reassembling the signal. Otherwise you would just introduce so many artifacts that it would be a problem, but that doesn't seem to happen.
Wow.
How much of what goes on in Audacity and programs like Audacity is well-known kind of mathematical theory, and how much of it is just art, is trying stuff and failing and trying it a different way?
I think that most of it is sort of by the book theory, and it's not really that deep. It's mainly in terms of the signal processing. These signal processing algorithms have been around for decades or centuries in some cases,
right.
And so it's really a pretty straightforward application. Although I will say that one of the things that we talked about at the very beginning with Audacity was the fact that most commercial audio editors at some time or another end up spending a lot of time copying data around. And it's very, I always found that very frustrating, that, you know, some editors, you remove 10 milliseconds at the beginning of a big sound file and it goes out and just crunches and crunches copying.
It's terrible.
The rest of the
sound. It's painful.
File. Yeah. And we thought, I mean, as a computer scientist, I just know that that can't be the right way to do it.
Right.
And that can't be necessary. And so from the very beginning, we designed Audacity to avoid that problem, to have some what I would consider just sensible data structures. I mean, these are things that a sophomore computer scientist should be able to figure out. And yet, you know, look around and who's doing that other than Audacity? And
so
that's why you can open up a huge file in Audacity and, you know, go in the middle and take out a little section of sound and you just get very fast redisplay and you can undo it again very fast. It's just all of these cut, copy, paste operations go really fast on Audacity.
So back in 99, I mean, the computer power relative to today must have been much smaller. Are there things you did back then to squeeze the last ounce of CPU and space out that today you would just go, who cares, and throw it around?
I would say no. I think one of maybe I was inclined to do that, and I have to give credit to Dominic. In many places, Dominic's just said, you know, this is... I want to get this done in a finite amount of time. And I should say that I did a lot of design work. I did a lot of implementation on certain aspects, but really the core of all of the audio and display stuff was actually implemented by Dominic. So, and when he was doing this, there were some places where he took a very expedient approach that seemed to me it was taking a lot of memory, and maybe that's because being older and having worked on so computers in 1999 were almost too fast for me to imagine. You know, I grew up doing music software on things like the Commodore Amiga and Mac Plus, where, you know, you'd be lucky to have a megabyte of memory and a few MIPS of processing speed. And so, for example, in Audacity, when you every time you do an editing operation, internally it makes a list of every disk block that's involved in that sound and just copies a list, not the actual disk blocks, but it copies pointers to all those disk blocks into memory, so that if you have to undo something, it just brings it all back. So to me, this, you know, every editing operation resulting in tens of thousands of bytes, hundreds of thousand bytes, maybe even a megabyte of data, you know, stashing it away just in case you want to undo an operation, that seemed terribly wasteful. But Dominic really made just the right engineering decision there, because machines did get faster and nobody ever complains about it. Nobody ever notices it. So I'd say no, that the thing that makes Audacity fast is just good basic design and algorithms. And it's not a lot of hand tuning and tweaking to, you know, to really push the CPU performance.
So your background was both audio and computers. How did you get into either or both of those?
Well, I started being interested in music, interested in engineering, and I was very taken by the early analog synthesizers that came out. I guess I was probably in high school when the Mini Moog and Sonic 6 and some other synthesizers appeared at a local music store, and you know, I just couldn't believe it. That's what I wanted to do and play with and explore. And so the computer science stuff came later as when I went to college, and I was initially I wanted to be an electrical engineer, but I really took to software and programming and all of the computer science concepts I was learning. And so kind of just moved towards that. But being a musician, I was I've been playing trumpet since I was 11 years old, and I still play actively and professionally. And that interest in music drew me to reading books, reading journals about computer music research. And I kind of kept it on the side all through college and grad school. So I have a PhD from Carnegie Mellon in the operating systems area. But once I got my PhD, I started doing some work in computer music. And a lot of people go through this. They, you know, you spend so much time and energy on finishing a PhD thesis that as soon as it's done, you just kind of look around and say, there's got to be something else in life. And I was interested in some music ideas, and I started trying them out. I soon discovered that that was really what I was thinking about. You know, all day long. It's when I get up and take a shower, I think about computer music. And if you're going to do research and be successful, you've got to do work in whatever you're thinking about, whatever you have a passion for. So really, ever since my PhD, I've been working in the music, kind of the intersection of computer science and music.
Can I ask you if you knew Randy Pausch?
Yes, I did.
Of course, he was a professor at CMU.
Right. So he came as a grad student shortly after I finished my PhD, and I was hired on as a research scientist here. I knew Randy for a long time.
Must have been a great inspiration. I mean, we just for people who don't know his name, of course, he gave the last lecture. That was an incredible video. In fact, I went back and watched his time management video, which I thought was incredible as well, and turned into a book. And of course, he passed away not so long ago, just a couple of months ago now, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So in fact, we just had a memorial service for him here on campus on Monday. Oh. So it's, you know, very much on people's minds.
Much loved. And his Alice is an incredible project.
Alice is very interesting and innovative, Randy worked on a lot of things very intensely and passionately, and has really influenced a lot of people. In fact, I mean, we were talking the other day. It's almost ironic that he could be the most famous computer scientist in the world
right now. Certainly, yeah. You know. I think that's probably true. It must be an amazing place to work, though. I mean, you know, there are a few institutions like Carnegie Mellon where just the best minds come, and it sounds like you get considerable freedom to work on your ideas.
Yeah, I would say that's true. It's it is an absolutely amazing place. When I came here, the first day I walked in the door, just as a prospective grad student, I guess I had been accepted, but I wanted to come check the place out. So I had a few appointments to see people, and one of those people was Alan Newell, who was the one of the founders of artificial intelligence and co-founder of cognitive psychology. Just an amazingly brilliant man. And I spent half an hour or so in his office. He was showing me what he was working on, and later I took courses from him as a grad student here. And just having those kinds of people around has been really inspiring. And also, I would say that, Alan Newell was a very special person to me, along with Herb Simon, who he worked with a lot, because both of them just had a very, very open mind about research. And I know that when my case came up for review and people looked at this guy and said, you know what, there must have been people, other faculty sitting around saying, you know, what is this guy doing? Like, what does music have to do with what we're about? And, you know, he's not getting these big Defense Department grants. And what's going on here? And I'm sure that Alan Newell and Herb Simon and some other very open-minded people that we've been fortunate to have here would say, you know, the subject doesn't matter. They're doing interesting work. Their peers regard this work highly, and it's always been our policy. Doesn't sound like the right word, but I guess that's it. That we evaluate other faculty by asking their peers if they're doing good work or great work that gets recognized around the world. And we don't try to say, you know, is this person doing something I'm especially interested in? That, you know, if we do that, then we become very insular.
Sure.
And we can't branch out and be open to new ideas.
It must also be very difficult to pick something and say, I want to study this. I mean, you started in operating systems, you moved to sound. Was it hard for you to decide on one area, or did you know I want to work on sound?
I think that sound and music made the decision for me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't feel like
you're a musician too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the funny thing is I should have known maybe when I was a grad student that's what I should be working
on. What's this operating system stuff anyway?
I think it took me that long to really honestly, you know, look at myself and where I was going and what I was doing and, you know, become as open-minded about it as maybe some guy like Alan Newell was.
he had more faith in you than you did in your own.
He probably did. And you know, I actually, looking back on it, I talked to some of these guys who knew me when I was a student, and I think they saw it at the time, you know, even before I did.
Yeah.
Can you actually have an honest appreciation for music still, or do you start thinking of things in terms of sound waves now when you listen?
I know music is music is life. It's if anything, it gets even more interesting because you see it from so many different dimensions. And
do you ever listen to a sound and go, well, that's a square wave plus a little bit of a triangle plus a third harmonic or whatever to try to figure out how to recreate it back in the lab?
All the time. But you know, a lot of times I listen to music and I say, wow, that is so far beyond what I can could really conceive of of building from first principles. Mm. I wonder what's going on in there, and I wonder how I could even think about it. And I think that's what happens with music is that it's so rich that you always find new things.
Why was the piano so hard to get right in the early synthesizers?
Probably computation. Well,
because it's computation, so rich in the overtones or something, or
yeah, I part of it is that anything that you're really familiar with is hard,
like human hands. Like that makes sense because the brain is so good at this, at detecting the subtle differences.
And so, being a trumpet player, when I listen to synthesized trumpets, I just immediately say, you know, what is that?
Trumpets sound terrible. They still sound terrible.
Oh, good. I'm glad it's not just
it's
me.
Not just you. They sound like a Casio. You have the distinction of being one of two professors at Carnegie Mellon who has performed on MTV, who's been seen on MTV.
That's right.
Is that with your band?
that was with, believe it or not, a big band, sort of a swing band, back many years ago. MTV was on some kind of MTV Across America tour, and they made a stop here in Pittsburgh, and we were playing on MTV.
Very cool.
Is that about they actually had music back then? I remember there's an MTV that had music
before Big Brother.
Oh yeah, right.
For the real world or whatever. But you also and you continue to play in a Dixieland band. I see.
Not a Dixieland band, but I play in a lot of bands, a jazz band, more modern jazz. I play in a kind of experimental jazz quartet.
Oh, wow.
With electric violin and drums and bass. And I do a lot of electronics on my trumpet. And most recently, I'm sub for a couple of months with the Edgewood Symphony Orchestra, which is doing a Bernstein's Symphonic Dance Suite, which is the West Side Story suite made into a orchestra concert performance.
Oh, how
and
beautiful.
I've always just really loved that, and yeah. it's a really challenging part. So I'm practicing hard.
So what's the most unusual use you've seen for Audacity?
Oh, the most interesting, unusual recent thing I've seen is some guy wrote to me working on that got some very high frequency, high bandwidth recordings of harbor porpoises, and he wanted to do look at some FFTs of what was going on, mm-hmm. and just try to, you know, look at the sound, play with it. Kind of the same thing we were building Audacity for in the very beginning. You know, here you've got this data. Let's take a look at it.
But it was for a different kind of porpoise.
Yeah. Oh, please. Oh, Randall. If I were next to you, I'd smack you right now.
It's a truly multi-porpoise editor.
Oh.
Oh.
So your current part of this is something called Nyquist. Now I know the Nyquist theorem. I obviously is named after what is it? Is it Sven Nyquist? What is his name? That's an interesting question there. Never heard his name. Is it? Now he's the guy. It's information theory in terms of music. Like how much bandwidth is required? I'm trying to remember the Nyquist theorem.
Yeah. Well, so Nyquist was the guy at and he was an engineer at Bell Labs. And he worked on sampling and sampling theory, and, right. and really is the guy that's credited with stating sampling theory, and which is the theory from which all digital audio
right.
comes. And the Nyquist theorem is just that you have to sample at double the highest frequency of the signal
right.
that you're trying to capture.
Right. So you call your project Nyquist just in honor to honor him?
Right, right.
It's a good name.
I kind of like the name. It's Nyquist comes up so much in everything we do that it seemed appropriate.
So what is Nyquist?
So Nyquist is a programming language, and it's a programming language especially created for working with sounds and audio.
Oh, wow.
It's really it's both a signal processing language and a music composition language. So the origins of Nyquist were that we were writing a lot of algorithms in the lab, trying to implement different audio effects and things. And what I saw happening is not only in our lab, but everywhere is that electrical engineer types would implement something in the code, and they'd make these really cool sounds and take them and show them to people, and composers would look at them and say, wow, you know, that's wonderful. I'd like to use that to make some music. And then the engineer tells them, well, you know, I've really only got this little demo program, and it can't handle any sound more than 3 seconds long. And we have, you know, there are all these limitations. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we had this framework of a music composition language where we could sort of drop in new algorithms and new audio effects. And once we got the effect working, we would immediately have it surrounded by this whole framework that would allow, that would sort of automatically deal with big sounds and allow you to mix it with other sounds and control it with a high level language. Wouldn't that really be great? So that was the plan for Nyquist. And I think to some extent that's been realized. We do end up with a lot of audio effects and algorithms getting kind of dropped into Nyquist, and they're out there for other people to use.
So Nyquist is fast enough to do, like, not necessarily real time, but like quick enough processing on your audio samples that you could build it up in a high level language and still work.
Yeah. Yeah. The way this works is that Nyquist has I'm not sure, I don't want to get too technical, but programming languages deal with data. So they have integers and they have floating point numbers and they have strings and character mm-hmm. data. And so Nyquist just has this other data type called a sound, which is actually has a very big, complicated implementation with a goal of making things as efficient as possible. And so these sounds get operated on by different operators, functions in the language. Mm-hmm. And at the lowest level, all of the operators and functions that process signals are written in C or something that's very efficient. And what's happening at the high level part of the language is you're just invoking these functions with parameters.
Ah.
So we're using a very sort of slow interpreter to decide what two signals to add together, or let's say. But then when we actually go to do the arithmetic, it's handled by really highly optimized compiled functions at the low level. So in some measurements I did, in a typical application, you'd spend about 3% of your time doing the high-level decision-making and 97% down in the inner loops running as efficiently as possible.
Ah, and, okay.
And it turns out that by spending that 3% at a very high level, you can oftentimes do some optimizations that make the low-level stuff run maybe twice as fast as it would in any other comparable system. Mm-hmm. So when we run benchmarks of Nyquist against other music synthesis languages like C sound, for example, Nyquist runs faster.
You say synthesis, you mean you can also start from scratch and say, I want to generate like a 12-note sequence of the ascending scale, and you could say this in Nyquist?
Yeah, that's right. So Nyquist has a lot of synthesis primitives like oscillators and pulse generators and envelope generators. So all the standard synthesis models and algorithms and paradigms are in there, as well as lots of other audio processing and audio effects.
So how many of the filters I'm looking at in a stock installation of Audacity are written in Nyquist then? I mean, I go to that, you know, transform menu. There's like a 30 things or 40 things in there. Are any of those written in Nyquist, or are all those just direct to some C call somewhere?
I believe that those are all direct calls to C, because there are, isn't there, I'd have to take a closer look.
Sorry.
It's pretty transparent, but I think that there's a separate menu that gets loaded up with a lot of Nyquist effects. But I'm not totally sure about that.
But I could, for example, create, like, say, a compress filter with Nyquist then and add that to my menu, right?
That's right. And the nice thing about Nyquist is that if you have some if you need some customized signal processing, in many cases you don't have to download the whole source for Audacity and figure out how to write everything in C and deal with Audacity data structures and stuff like that. You can write in this very high-level scripting language, which is Nyquist, and Audacity already has the code to send the samples into Nyquist to get processed and take them back out and put them into your into your audio track. So you can sort of mix and match and combine all the operators that are built into Nyquist and build all kinds of things.
So you could actually then share with your friends and like trade Nyquist patches or whatever they would call it, right?
Right. And people do that. There's a pretty active bulletin board that's Audacity Nyquist users where people discuss different patches that they've come up with and bugs and that they're trying to solve and that kind of thing. There are hundreds of plugins and patches that are written in Nyquist for Audacity.
Well, I haven't heard bulletin board since the 80s, but okay. A place to exchange information like a
discussion,
wiki site or something.
What's the discussion list or some mailing list.
or something. Yes, great. That's cool though. So people are able to get people who aren't programmers can then get, well, not heavy hardcore programmers, but like scripters, you know, lightweight scripters can do things with Nyquist to do sound generation and filtering and stuff without having to go down into the C code level.
Right, right. And a lot of people will go out and look for something similar to what they need and see how to make a few changes. So, yeah, people that are not advanced programmers or even people that know, you know, people use it that don't necessarily know Nyquist very well at all, but they kind of slog through it by examples.
Now, when you started Audacity, did you instantly say this has to be open source? Or did you think about that for a while? Or obviously, being in research, you probably said for sure.
Yeah, I actually don't remember the discussions. But given that we had a project with a number of people trying to share this code, the idea of trying to make the thing commercial, I don't think really. I'm sure we didn't talk about it. Ever talk about it seriously. And in fact, you know, we were trying to get something started, and you know, the easiest way to kill it would have been to say, hey, let's make a company or something, because we'd never get the other people contributing. We'd never get people to just try it out for fun, because it wouldn't be free. I mean, there's so many obstacles in the way of starting up a commercial product like this.
And is this under a GPL2 or?
That sounds right. You know, okay. I don't.
Sorry.
Or three, or you know, who knows?
I should have looked at the Wikipedia page first. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, maybe I should have too. I'm really these licenses. To me, they're necessary and they're important, but mm-hmm. for somebody that just wants to do work and share their work, sometimes it just really gets to mm-hmm. be an incredible pain to try to really understand what's the distinction between this and that, and can I mix, a library written with this license with some other library. It's stuff I stay away from.
Okay. Now, what bit rate do you rip your MP3s at?
Now, there's a question I'm interested in.
MP3s.
What are those?
I don't use MP3s.
I could have told you that. Musicians hate MP3s usually.
I copy when I copy CDs. I copy them as WAV files, and
wow.
When I get around to it, I compress them with FLAC. Which mm-hmm. is lossless,
right?
Open standard. So that gives you about a factor of two. Probably, I mean, if I were going to do MP3s, I'd probably go for a factor of five, which is not that much better. You know, I think it's better to just spend the money on disk drives and not do lossy compression.
So what is it? What are you hearing in an MP3? What are these people saying they can hear? And I'm sure you can hear it, and I can't quite yet. But what is it that people are saying when they got like 128K MP3, which probably sounds like trash to you, but why is 128 kilobits not enough to hold the information from audio that only goes up to 44 kilohertz? Maybe that's a long show, but...
Yeah, well, for me, to be honest, I rarely listen to music in pristine conditions. You know, I'm more likely to hear something in my car than in a clean listening environment. So to be honest, I don't think that I would really notice under any normal circumstances. There are very slight distortions that people do hear at those rates. And for me, I think it's more just the principle of why would I want to take this information that I like and that I'm listening to and degrade it when I don't really need to.
And similar to that, the 44.1 kilohertz cutoff for CDs, or a lot of audiophiles say they can hear that too. Can you hear that in music when it's sampled for a CD?
I can't. Okay. And I, this is something I'm very interested in because I see more and more studios are recording in 24-bit, 98, 192 kilohertz sampling mm-hmm. rates. And I'm really very skeptical of whether anyone can really hear the difference. And I think the real test would be not, you shouldn't take a 44.1 kilohertz system and compare it directly to a 192 kilohertz system. What you should do is take the 192 kilohertz system, downsample it, very carefully with, you know, the proper signal processing, which is non-trivial, but mm-hmm. downsample it to 44.1 and then upsample it back to 192. So then you've got exactly the same hardware. You've just removed all the high frequencies because of Nyquist. He'll tell you that there's the high frequencies have to be gone after you've downsampled and upsampled again. And then do the listening test. And my guess is if people are hearing a difference, what's really happening is people are spending more money and engineers are working harder to make those 192 kilohertz systems really sound good. Mm-hmm. And they're just hearing the difference in quality and care building analog, digital to analog converters.
Okay, and one last audio geek question, and then I'll stop.
No, don't stop. This is fun. I love it.
Gold-plated audio cables. Gold-plated.
Oh, come on. Come on.
It's interesting that you ask. I don't use them. I read one study.
Gold a crappy conductor?
No, gold is a great conductor.
Is it? I thought it was a bad conductor.
But does it make any difference? Should I spend $100 on a 6-foot cable?
Yeah, gold is a better conductor than silver, and silver is better than copper.
Okay.
And so, and also gold is soft, so it tends to make really good contacts. So
for a while.
Until it wears off.
Yeah. Okay.
But can you hear that in the audio? Does it make any difference?
Well, I only know of one careful study really comparing the two with a blind, or maybe it was a double blind study, because you don't want people to know, you know, mm-hmm. what they're listening to, or they start imagining differences. And in this study, most people could not tell any difference. One subject actually could tell the difference above chance. You know, you would just say, you would listen to the thing twice, and then you ask them, is this the same or different? And they could tell above chance rates that they really were different. But the interesting thing was they could not express a preference for one or the other.
Oh, I can hear a difference, but I don't know which is better.
Wow.
Right. So my conclusion is spend the money on good speakers.
Yes.
Ah, yes.
Lots bit better difference there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was okay.
No. Don't end now. Now we're getting somewhere. So, okay. What kind of speakers, Roger?
Oh, there we go.
Now we're asking the right questions.
Oh.
He doesn't want to endorse any particular manufacturer.
Free ones. The ones
just
to get
whisper
to the
it. Whisper it in my ear.
I use a lot of different speakers, and I guess I don't spend a lot of money on speakers, and I'm not running a studio or something where, where I have to have the latest and greatest to impress people. So I think I'm the wrong person to ask.
You know what? I have a friend who's a professional musician also who says, we tend not to be audiophiles because we know what real music sounds like, and it's pretty hopeless.
That's how, when I listen to music, I'm really not listening for audio quality. I'm really listening for the music.
You accept the fact that it's reproduction. It's never going to ever sound as good as it does when you're sitting in the orchestra, as you get to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so, I'm definitely not an audiophile.
Yeah. I find that to be the case almost always. And yet you know so much. It's interesting that you can dissect a sound. I know visual artists. Randall, I'm thinking of Alex Lindsay, our friend, who says every time he's always looking at specular highlights and things. When he looks at the real world, he's always thinking, how would I render this in 3D? And I imagine that's a kind of the same thing with audio.
I've known computer graphics guys that, you know, would walk into an art gallery and instead of looking at the paintings, they look at the specular reflection on the wax and the floor and the luster, and they say, wow, how did they do that?
Alex says he'll spend 20 minutes looking at a spoon. It's it's a bad disease, I think.
Yeah.
Well, definitely. I again, Roger, let me thank you for Audacity, because it is amazing to have a program of this quality. This is the program when people say, well, can open source ever be any good? But that you point to and you say, look, look at this. Just an amazing product.
Well, I would like to thank Dominic Mazzoni and then all the other developers out there that have really turned it from, you know, a laboratory grade interesting little application into something that's really world class.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, it's obviously a group effort. I mean, no open source project is or few are done and by one person, and when they are, they're small.
If somebody wants to contribute to Audacity, I mean, what would somebody need? Like skill in C++ or C, or do you know what it's written in?
Mainly C++.
Oh,
of course, there are lots of jobs, including translation into languages. There are a huge number of languages supported now, but
so you don't have to be a programmer at all. You just have to speak another language.
Right. So the project has people that work on documentation. It has C++ developers. There's a whole range of talents that the project can use.
At this point, is a lot of the programming going into plugins, or is it still in the body of the work?
Oh, there's still a lot of just kind of core Audacity work going on. Mm-hmm. Things to, for example, make label tracks better. There's some recent work on better support for compression formats. There's a lot of work going on at all sorts of levels. Mm. One of the things I should mention, one of the things that I've been doing that kind of brought me back into really serious hacking on Audacity, and that is we're adding a feature that will let people automatically align audio to MIDI data. So if you have, if you have a favorite pop song that you and some friends are trying to play in a band, and you want to play along, let's say you need a drummer, but you want it done sort of the way it was on the original record, you can find a MIDI file for that song, load it up into Audacity, and say align, and what it will do is basically transfer the tempo and all the timing of the audio into the MIDI that you can then save back out and play. And so another application of that is that if you load up some audio that you have a score for, so if you're trying to record some music maybe that you've written, you can load up a MIDI version of that, line it up with the audio recording, and then you'll not only be able to look at the waveforms, but you'll be able to look down below at an actual, well, sort of a piano roll representation of that, which really helps with navigation to find out where the notes began and end and what section of music you're in.
Oh, Roger, you have a patent. What's it on?
Oh, yeah.
If it's intermittent windshield wipers, we don't mention it.
So the patent is, I was thinking, is talking about patents on this show going to get me into trouble? Or
No. Everybody's got to make a living, right?
But we can talk about that. But anyway, the patent is for computer accompaniment, which is kind of related to this alignment. What computer accompaniment does is it listens to a live musician playing, and it synchronizes an accompaniment to that live musician.
Ooh.
So if I want to practice the Haydn trumpet concerto, I can turn on this program and play and hear the orchestral or a piano accompaniment to the Haydn while I play. And it allows me to speed up and slow down and play expressively while this computer is playing an accompaniment. Just like having a person play along with you.
Oh, that's neat.
So you'd have to be pre-scored, though. It wouldn't be making up something that sort of fills in what you're doing.
That's right. That's right. It's okay. Pre-scored, which sort of makes the problem both easier and harder. You know, it's harder because you can't just play anything. You have to play the right notes at the right time. Uh-huh. But at least, you know, the right notes are already notated and known to the computer.
The technology that lets you do fill-in below somebody's lead is really interesting, too. Is that something you have experience with?
It's something that I've written some programs to do just for my own practice. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I did this, was doing this and practicing along with my own little, automatic accompaniment generator MIDI files. And then somebody told me about Band in a Box, which, you know, back in the 80s,
I looked great at it and said, program. Oh, wow. That was an awesome program, man.
What a great idea. You know, I really felt like, I've been scooped by, really scooped by these guys, but, you know, that's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Roger. Thank you for taking the time. We really appreciate it. And again, thank you for a program that we all use. Mm-hmm. And you've kind of stimulated me to try it again. I'm using we use Audition, a commercial program, to record and edit. And maybe we should be thinking about open source.
Yeah, we'll give it a shot. And if there's something you think should be done to improve it, be sure to
let
me and developers know. And
let you know.
And
mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. It's always changing.
Thank you so much.
But thanks. It's really been great to talk to you guys.
Thanks. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Take care.
Okay, you too.
I wish I were a college kid. I'd go to Carnegie Mellon. I wish I could go there.
It's a great place.
Oh, I bet it is. I bet it is.
CMU hosted the first YAPSE back in the day.
Really?
The first Perl conference, yet another Perl conference.
Yeah.
And I think they're hosting one coming up next year, too. So.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Thank you, Roger. Take care.
Hey, you're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Roger Dannenberg. Bye. You know, a lot of courses now are going online, Randall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I probably could go to CMU a little bit, but I should check what's... Did you see that Stanford has put its undergraduate comp sci courses, the courses that every undergraduate at Stanford takes, online, the lectures,
Only the first dozen or so. Yeah, I looked in there. There wasn't anything that I would be interested in spending a lot of time reading.
Well, you know it all.
Well, no, I don't. There's a lot of things I don't know. I'm a street-trained programmer, and there's a lot of comp sci stuff that I really don't know and really want to know someday when I have some spare time, like I could actually get some of that. But I mean, like, there's a lot of stuff like in compiler theory and parsing techniques and things that I would love to learn about, and I'm waiting for some open course somewhere that I could just start reading my way through. So, but yeah, the Stanford stuff, I took a look at that as soon as I saw the announcement, and it looks like a good start. It looks like, they said they're trying these first 10 programs, and they're going to flesh it out based on requests and based on feedback that they get and so on. So I'm happy they're doing it. I know that MIT did some of this too as well early on, and I think it's really great that instructors are and universities are making this kind of information available, because there's people like me that actually learn better sort of away from a classroom environment.
Yeah,
and
or there's people
pace.
Like me who are old and you know. Never studied computer science, because when I was in school, computer science meant you had to go to the computer lab in the basement and bring punch cards with you. So it's changed so much. And
they had electricity when you were going to school?
No, well, only during during daylight hours, actually. So okay. I have to. So you're saying that they didn't put the whole lecture series up there? I thought they did. I'm a little surprised.
They have 10 programs, 8 to 10 programs, and each one of those is complete. But it's just a small part of their offerings.
Of the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, so, and they're just phasing it in. They're just saying, well, let's try this first. Let's get some feedback about it. And there was one or two that was interesting in the CS area, but there was a couple in, I think, EE, and it wasn't all that interesting for me. But
I would take that introductory course because I'm an idiot.
Yeah, so,
Now, I'll tell you what. My alma mater has started to do this, too, and I think you're going to see universities doing this everywhere. Yale has an Open Yale Courses at open.yale.edu.
Mm-hmm.
And these, they've really taken a lot of care to do great quality video in a variety of sizes and formats. You get all of the lecture notes and everything. And I'm just looking to see, they have astronomy. I see they have game theory, which would be kind of fun, but that's an econ course. Yeah. But wouldn't that be interesting?
Oh, you know, I could never get enough education. I mean, I spend... I spend, you know, at least minutes a day, if not hours a day, either strolling through Wikipedia or reading some new PDF that I stumbled across or whatever. I think
pretty soon you won't have to go to college anymore. You'll just use these free offerings from these, you know, MIT has put most of their coursework online. Stanford's putting a lot of it. Yale's putting more and more.
You're talking to a guy who's self-educated, so it's already there.
We love that.
It works.
I mean, frontiers of biomedical engineering. You can get a new career. I
figured spending 8 years in the industry was better for my ultimate wallet than spending 8 years at a college. So that's the way I choose to do it.
I think you're probably right. In fact, I read an article recently that questions the whole notion of a 4-year BA program. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan. I believe in a liberal arts education, I'm going to encourage my kids to do that because I just think people need to be well-rounded, you know, I mean. Nowadays, I'm glad I took economics in college, right?
Well, you know, that's what I'm finding more of is I'm actually more fascinated now by the things that I thought were yucky in high school. Right.
Yeah. See, that's
the problem. Which is really sort of interesting.
College is wasted on the young, as are most things.
No, but I was career oriented from the time I was 9. So I focused entirely on computers from the time I was 9. And by the time I was 16, I got out of high school and I was teaching stuff in high school and I was working, writing code at $30 an hour in 1977 at age 15. So, you know, it was quite fun. So I thought, why go to school? You know, 'cause I've already got that down. And, but now I'm looking back going, okay, I shouldn't have been so focused on my education for career. I should have also spent some time doing liberal arts and other less productive, financially less productive things, and didn't do that. So here I am.
But you've got a great career.
I love it. I wouldn't trade it for the world. You know, I'm sitting here chatting with you.
Let me ask you a question, because you're over 40 now, right?
I'm 46. Yeah.
I've always wondered this. You know, they always say mathematics is a young man's game, physics is a young man's game. Is programming a young man's game?
I think there are clearly some things that I can't quite do as well now as I could 20 years ago in terms of absorbing new things. But you know what? I've got the advantage of having seen a lot of stuff over 20 years. Yeah, so the experience is what gets me by. I can stare at a project and go, this smells. I don't have to work through why it smells. I just know it does.
Right.
And that's an advantage.
That's a huge advantage.
Yeah, and so
do you find your mind as acute as it used to be? I understand you don't learn as readily. That's, of course, that does happen with age. But I find it's harder for me to concentrate. One of the things that, and again, you're a real programmer. I just play with a thing when I was younger. I found that when I was younger, I was able to hold all the threads in my mind of many different things going on at once, and I find it more difficult to do.
No, and that's one thing that actually hasn't decreased with time. I don't think I'd learn new things quite as easily, but you should watch me program. There's this sort of weird thing where I'm doing where I just am simply staring at my Emacs buffer for like 20 minutes, but I'm actually sorting through in my head about 15 different strategies and ways and where those will lead, and it's all just, it's the same thing I used to do when I was 15. It really hasn't changed. I still have exactly the same strategy about how to code a piece of programming. So I don't think that's changed for me. And I think that's probably why I'm still pretty skillful in that area. That part hasn't gone away. That I think that's probably going to be the last to die. I'm going to be on my deathbed when I'm, you know, 102 based on life extension. And I'm going to be saying C squared minus B times 3. You know, that's probably where I'm going to go with this. You know, I'll be the last thing I'll be doing is writing a piece of code. I'm pretty sure.
Well, I find I can still write the small scripts, but if it gets too complex and too big, I just can't encompass it in my brain anymore.
Maybe that goes away between 46 and 51.
So yeah, maybe, I'm a little older than you.
5 years minus a week, man. We're exactly 1 week off on our birthday.
Oh, so, that's right. Well, upcoming happy birthday to you then.
Yeah, exactly. Coming around.
Speaking of upcoming, what do you have on the docket? You've put up a spreadsheet. Can people see that now of potential
guests?
Well,
I'm pretty sure that by the time this show pushes, there's going to be a link on it on twit.tv/floss. If they go there, they'll find a link to my spreadsheet, which has all the upcoming shows. And this is live as I am going through the week, talking to people, trying to book people. I mean, you should see the number of pieces of email I get in and send out just to book one guest. But you know, I'm sure you know, because you do shows all the time.
Yeah.
But this is actually what you're looking at. I found a way in Google Spreadsheets to have a view that's public that you guys can see that has basically the people and the projects I'm talking to and the sort of public status. Are they booked yet? Or am I looking for a slot? and so on. And so coming up as of right now, if you went there right now, what you would see is that we have Ken Kaur on next week. Now, I've talked about him a few times on previous shows. He's with the Apache Software Foundation.
Oh,
he's also a very, very well-respected and well-sought-out speaker at open source conferences around the world. I think the last two times I saw him was down in Brazil. And also OSCON up here in Portland. So I've seen him recently, but we finally got a slot for him. He's fitting in October 1st. We'll be taping that show. And then immediately following, these guys contacted me, the GNU Step people. Now, the OpenStep was originally what was used to create, I don't want to get too much into the show here, but GNU Step people are coming on in a couple weeks. I've got, I'm really looking forward to this, Aaron Sego. I've been at conferences all around the world with him, literally. I mean, Brazil and Mexico City and Venezuela and Portland and everything. He's with the KDE project. He's one of the guys at Trolltech, works on the KDE project. And KDE just had a big release recently, if I recall. And so Aaron, wonderful speaker, happy to be doing a show with him coming up soon. And those are guys on the confirmed list. We've been moving around a little bit, trying to get the one of the lead developers of Wine. We were going to tape last week, Paul Loudon of the Rockbox project, and he's unfortunately in Houston, which got Hurricane Ike through there, and he lost his power.
He still doesn't have power as we're
recording
this.
Still doesn't have his power, right. So we're trying to, as soon as he gets some power and gets some network back, we'll be putting him back in the slot for that. I'm talking also on the short list with Joe Armstrong of the Erlang project. And
that one will be fun. Erlang is getting a lot of attention right now.
Absolutely.
I'm a language buff. I collect languages, so I always like to hear more about languages.
That's going
to
be great. And I've also been talking to the guys at Trolltech that are particularly about the Trolltech people that are working on WebKit. And
that'll be
although
fun.
I can't get any of the Apple people because they aren't allowed to talk to press people, but I can get the guys at Trolltech that are working with them day by day. And so
WebKit is right now is my browser of choice.
Huge.
On Macs. I don't know how it runs on Windows, but I've never seen such a fast browser in my life. Faster than Chrome.
So we're getting all these shows put in place. Please keep your suggestions coming. Again, if you go to twit.tv/flosh, you'll see my email address. You can go there and send me email. That's fine. I love that stuff. Although I would suggest now that if you see a name already on the list, now that the list is public, you don't need to send it to me. You could say, I really, really want that. I'll try to bump it up on priorities. Yeah,
well,
I already know.
If you ever want to do polls, we could do some polls on your page.
Yes. Yeah,
although I hate to put up people and say, would you rather see Richard Stallman or Eric Raymond? I mean, that's no good. We don't want to do that.
That and you know, part of what actually sort of decides it for me is, first, how familiar am I with it? What have I done in the previous 3 weeks on the show? I mean, there's a lot of things that go into this. So a simple poll is not really going to help that much. Speaking of other shows, though, again, I've got to plug podcast.insightcruises.com, my other podcast from the shows that we tape from the cruises that we go on that you'll be on next summer.
I'm
again.
I'm so excited.
Yes.
We're going to China. We're going to China. It's not sold out yet, is it? Can people still go?
I don't know. I'm not Neil. I don't know where the China thing is right now.
Let me go. So it's insightcruises.com.
Yes, and I want to say we're just starting a sequence to time it with the whole Large Hadron Collider. We've got I forget his name. Oh, he's going to kill me for this. Dr. Abel, Thomas Abel is a Big Bang theorist, and I've got a sequence for the next 3 or 4 weeks talking about the origin of the universe, what happened in those first few microseconds.
This is on Insight Cruises News. You have the Scientific American folks who are incredible.
Exactly, and so this is the sequence I'm starting this weekend to time it with the LHC. So.
Are you going Mac Mania 8 next month?
I am, in fact, going to be there, and we're going to pre-record a couple of shows.
This is going to be it's the Eastern Mediterranean. You're going to go to Alexandria. You're going to go to Sicily, Turkey. So jealous.
Greece again.
It's probably is sold out, but if you go to insightcruises.com, they've got many coming up. Evolution Emanation with Scientific American is a Panama Canal cruise in February. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare at Sea next spring. Mac Mania 9, that's the one I'm going on.
Exactly.
To the Far East. And I am doing the pre-cruise China tour as well. And
which is a private sort of tour. It's actually going to go some places that most tourists don't get to go, which is going to be really
You know,
great.
I was a Chinese major. I've never been to China. I cannot wait. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested, please go to insightcruises.com. And
join us. Join me.
Are you going to go on the pre-China too?
I'll be on everything pretty much that's on that website. So yes,
I'm doing the post-cruise Beijing. I'm going to just do the pre-cruise China tour and then the Mac Mania 9. That's 2 weeks away from Twit Live. That's all that Dane will let me do. But We're going to have to record some shows on the boat because I can't afford to not do these shows. I don't know how we're going to get them uploaded, but I bet you, come to think of it, we're landing in Korea. So if I record shows before we land in Korea, I know I can upload from Korea.
There's got to be Japan, a net there somewhere.
I think they have the internet in Japan now. No, they have the fastest internet in the world in Korea. I think we're going to be able to get these shows uploaded for the first time. You know, when we were cruising around the Caribbean is another matter entirely.
Oh, yeah, and I think finding three or four people that can talk about the Mac on a Mac cruise.
That'll be fun. So we'll do some Mac Break weeklies. We might do two Mac Break weeklies. If we get enough on the pre-cruise China tour, if you're a Mac fan, go on that. We'll do a Mac Break weekly there. Yeah. Who's going on Mac Mania 9? Let me just see.
Oh, I don't know. It's all on the website.
Is Sammy Inako going?
I don't know.
I can't remember if he's going or not. Yeah. I know I talked to David Pogan. He can't go, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I was really looking forward to seeing David again.
Oh, yeah. He's a cool guy.
Oh, I love David. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I brought the site down by mentioning it. So
I can't
get there and see. But I think there's a bunch of really interesting. I think Derek Story's going.
Yep.
Who's going? There's some people that I know that I love. I think Don McAllister's going, right? From the screencasts online.
Right.
So it's going to be a great, great, great time.
Should be really cool.
All right, Randall.
See you next week.
See you next week. That's it. Now it's popped up. Let me see who's going to be on here. Andy is going to be on it. Yay.
There we go. Yes,
Andy
Inako,
Don McAllister, Leo Laporte. He's okay. And Derek Story. Should be fun. Should be really fun. And let's not forget Randall Schwartz.
That's right.
And we can do a floss on the boat.
That'd be great.
We can just, you know, go.
We do a floss. We do a Mac Break Weekly. We could probably even get away with a Twit show, too.
We're definitely doing a Twit. Are you kidding?
There you go. Yeah, Twit at Sea.
Don, Andy, and me, that's Twit.
There we go.
We do a Twit at Sea. Remember? And then the captain's announcement came on in the middle.
I know. That was great.
We are now going to the Isthmus of Fistness. Yeah.
Our altitude is 0 feet above sea level.
Practically said that. Randall Schwartz, we'll talk again next week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you on Floss Weekly.